January 12th, 2014, Rabbi David Silber on Megillat Esther.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Tonight is the second of the two shiurim. And tonight's shiur is sponsored in the merit of a refuah shleima for Miriam Minna bat Aliza Batya by her grandparents, Barbara and Stanley Shapiro. So last week, we discussed elements of the story of Migdal Bavel. And this week, the topic is Megillat Esther. No doubt you're wondering, is there a connection between these two topics? Seem rather random. Excuse me? Mem and Gimel. Well, hopefully we can find other connections too. That's true. I did want to make one announcement actually about Drisha before we begin, which is this, that in the summer, that is June, July, we have a couple of programs that I think might be of interest, should be of interest to you. June and July programs, we have two programs for college students. In July we have many programs actually, but we have specifically college programs. In June it's actually for men and women, college students, and for July is women only. And we also in July have a program for high school girls. We run for many years. So one of our better programs, I would say. So if any of you know of college students or high school girls who want to learn Torah this summer, you can send them our way if it's an appropriate match. It would be good. I think it's very strong programs, and the students get a lot from them. This evening, the topic is Megillat Esther. So Megillat Esther is a vast topic, and there are many, many things to say about the Megillah. What I thought might be interesting is to think of Megillat Esther possibly in conjunction with Migdal Bavel. The truth is that Megillat Esther contains many, many allusions to various biblical texts, and much has been spoken and written about these connections. The story of Yosef, of course, has many links, literary links and thematic links to the Megillah. The stories of kingship in Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Melachim also are very much connected to the Megillah. Sefer Daniel is a book which is clearly parallel to and related to both the story of Yosef and the Megillah. But I wanted this evening to think about the Megillah in conjunction with Migdal Bavel. And the Migdal Bavel, one of the main points of last week, the question I raised last week is, what is the place of Migdal Bavel within the biblical narrative? Migdal Bavel is a short story of 9 verses that appears in the 11th chapter of Sefer Bereshit. What is it doing there? From a literary standpoint, what is it doing there? The suggestion last week was that Migdal Bavel, which is the building of the city and the tower within it, the tower which the inhabitants claim will ascend to the heavens, Migdal v'roshol b'shamayim v'naseh lanu shem, so we have a city and we have a tower, we have a special place where the world is gathered after the flood, and we have within that special place, a very special place, a tower that ascends to the heavens. And that if we think about the structure of Sefer Bereshit, what is clear is that the book begins with two stories of creation. The first is creation of heaven and earth, which is essentially the beginning of the Torah. the perfect creation in 6 days, God resting on the seventh day. And then there is the second creation story, which is not about heaven and earth, but about a very special place. Gan b'Eden b'Kedem, one might say the sacred space, the space in which God and the human, God's favorite creation, can inhabit together. And that story of the second element of creation is about the opportunity of Gan Eden and the banishment from Gan Eden, the Nachash who is present. But essentially it ends up with the banishment from that special place. And then the Torah says the world is completely destroyed, and then the world is recreated in two stages. In the first stage, we have the recreation, one might say, of heaven and earth, story of Noah, who recreates the first chapter. Tzelem Elohim is the term that appears in the Noah story. He's commanded to fill the earth, to populate the earth. He's given dominion over the animals, even more than Adam was in the first chapter. He governs the earth. But he doesn't set up any particular space in this world. He doesn't create a special place, a sacred place. That task is left to the one who follows him 10 generations later, namely Abraham, who both in God's first command and God's last command, he is instructed, Lech Lecha, to go to a very particular place that God sends him. In the first instance, it is the land, Haaretz, Asher Hareka, sacred land. And in the last command, the Lech Lecha is El HaMakom Asher Omar Elecha, which is the sacred space, the place of the altar, the place in the future where God is to be seen, God is found. Asher Yamir Hayom Bahar Hashem Yera'eh. So we have in the story of Abraham both the uncovering or discovering of the sacred place in general, and then we have within that place the very special place, Har HaMoriah, where God is to be found, seen and sees. Migdal Bavel in this frame is the, one might say, the false sacred space. It's both a city, it's an ear, and it's also Migdal V'Roshel B'Shamayim. It's the attempt of humanity to set up their own sacred space, not the one that God is choosing, but the one that they choose, for the purpose, in their own words, of Nasel Anu Shem, to make a name for themselves, and Sham, in that place, to set up this special place that ascends to the heavens. So Migdal Bavel, in fact, was humanity's attempt to create both, to affirm both the place in general and the place within the place. God is displeased with this, and God is causing them to be confused. The language is confused. Umisham efisam Hashem al pnei kol haaretz. That's the setting of Migdal Bavel within the larger scheme of Sefer Bereishit. That scheme itself has all kinds of interesting implications, which we can't get into this evening. But last week I ended by saying, let's imagine, though, what would be if we never left Bavel? What kind of world would it be if the people in Bavel were never dispersed, if they weren't scattered over the face of the earth? The means of God scattering them or dispersing them, says the Torah, is that their language became confused. Asher lo yishmu ish svat re'ehu, they spoke a different language. And because they spoke a different language, they're scattered over the entire earth. So there is no unity, there's just disunity. What separates people is that they have a different language. But let's imagine what would be, imagine, if in fact somehow, even though people spoke different languages, something would actually unify them. And that exactly is the setting that we find in the beginning of a little book we're all familiar with called Megillat Esther. It's exactly how the book begins. The book begins by affirming, both in the first chapter and beyond, that in this kingdom, in this world, there's one king, HaMelech, where it appears many, many times throughout the Megillah, as we all know. There's one king, but there are many different states in his world, 127 to be precise. However, each one has its own writing and its own language. Kichtavam v'chilshonam. And yet, one gets the sense in the Megillah that it's not 127 diverse countries which have nothing to do with each other, even though they speak a different language. In fact, one of the first directives in the beginning of the Megillah is that in each family, that the man will determine the language of that particular family. Umedaber kilshon amo, which is at least one reading of that pasuk, and yet the Megillah speaks of one king. There's only one king in the Megillah, from beginning to end, Hamelech. It begins with Achashverosh, and it ends with Achashverosh. The means of unifying these peoples, basically in the Megillah, has to do with what you might call din, dat v'din. There's a law common to all the states. In fact, the very word medina, which appears in the Megillah over and over, medina u'medina, the word medina is related to the word din. It's a place. Each state has. It's a place where there are laws, but the laws are not determined by the state. It would appear, the law is determined by the king and the king's inner circle, and the means of publicizing or affirming the king's laws, which apply to everybody, is the sefer, is the book or the letters that is sent out to the various states. And that's what the Megillah affirms. The Megillah affirms that you can have 127 different languages, but everybody listens at least to one voice, to the voice of the king. So in that sense, it's interesting that the Megillah certainly reminds us of the story of Migdal Bavel, but with a twist, because in the Megillah, one has the sense that there is one rule for all. In fact, the accusations against the Jews, who have no state. Everybody has their own state. The Jews have no state in the Megillah. They live in all the states. Yeshno am echad mefuzar u'meforad bein ha'amim b'chom medinot malchutecha v'datehem shall not be kolam. The crime of the Jews, says Haman, doesn't say the word Jews, but the crime of this particular people is that they have their own laws. They don't obey the king's edicts, and there's one law for everybody. But they don't have a state, but they do have a language. Later in the Megillah, if you remember, when Mordechai sends around the letters, and even the first second letter sent by the king, that the Jews have the right to defend themselves, the letters are written to all the Medinot and to the Jews in their writing and in their language. So even though they have no state at all, but they are a people. What determines them as a people is that they have their own ketav and their own lashon. So it's an interesting point of departure this evening to imagine what would be in such a situation where, in fact, there is one king, there is one melech for the world. We haven't gone beyond chapter 11 of Sefer Bereishit. Imagine living in this place called Bavel. What would it be like to live in Bavel? That's, I think, what the Megillah invites us to imagine. And I would say that the Megillah invites us to imagine something else in addition to living in Bavel, because the story of Migdal Bavel is chapter 11 of Sefer Bereishit. Then we have a bunch of names afterwards. And after the names, we have another story, the next story. The next story in the Chumash is God telling Avraham, Lech Lecha. It's chapter 12. So Avraham is commanded to leave his place, his land, but not to go into exile, but to go to the place that I will show you. And Avraham goes. He takes his family with him, and 10 verses later, the Torah says there's a famine in the land, and Avram decides to go down to Egypt. And when he goes to Egypt, even before he gets to Mitzrayim, in the 12th chapter, he speaks to his wife Sarai, and he says to her that you're very beautiful, and we go down to Mitzrayim, they will see you, and they will think I'm your husband. And they will kill me and they will take you. Please say you're my sister. L'man yitavli bavurech, that it go well for me. V'chaita nafshi b'gorech, and you live. And the Torah says that, in fact, that's what happens. That they go down to Mitzrayim, not exactly as Avraham had planned. Again, the reading of that story, different commentators over time have understood the story differently. But one thing we can agree upon is that what Avram was afraid it might happen, in fact happens. Because the Torah says, Vayiru otos sarei paro, chapter 12, see in your Chumash, the officers of Pharaoh saw her, and they praised her to Pharaoh, Vatukacha isha beit paro, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh. We Avram etiv bavura, but Avram was it went well for Avram because of her, and he was given many gifts. And then God plagues Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says to Avram, "What have you done?" And he deports Avram and Sarai and the possessions, and they leave the land of Mitzrayim. It's the first story that we have in the Chumash about Mitzrayim. The name Mitzrayim appears earlier as one of the sons of Ham. He's Canaan's brother, but the first narrative about Mitzrayim is chapter 12. And that's actually a very important narrative in general and has some relevance for us this evening as well. And the importance is this. It's actually a very important point about that story. In that story, Avram is afraid something might happen. And in fact, something does happen. Exactly what he was afraid of. What actually happens in that story? So, the Torah says that the officers of Pharaoh saw her. Vayiru ota sarei paro, vatukacha isha beit paro, and the woman was taken. We have it, the seeing and the taking. They don't ask any questions about whom this woman is. They see her and they take her. That's the 12th chapter of Bereishit. Now, seeing and taking has appeared earlier in the Chumash. In fact, if you think about it, it appears twice in the Chumash prior to chapter 12. The first time it appears is chapter 3. The story of Gan Eden, the story of the snake who speaks to the woman, the Isha, and says to her that, sort of entices her to eat of this forbidden fruit. The Chumash says that after the snake speaks to the Isha, Vatera ha'isha, ki tova eitz l'machal v'chitava l'aynayim nechmaru haskil, v'tikach mipiyo v'tochal. The woman saw, says the Chumash, that the fruit was very good to eat. She saw that. It was very enticing. And v'tikach, she took. She didn't obey the command. She knew of the command, even though she herself was not commanded. She knew of it. And she saw that it was good, and she took. So we have three terms, the seeing and the taking, and it's good. It's chapter 3 of Bereishit. Now we move to chapter 6 of Bereishit. And lo and behold, we have a precise repetition of those three terms in chapter 6. There it says that when the human being began to multiply over the face of the earth, it's chapter 6, Shulchan in the Chumash, I mean, I think I'm being accurate, but shouldn't trust me, says, when the human began to multiply over the face of the earth, it says, Vayiru b'neho Elohim, and they had, and daughters were born to them. Vayiru b'neho Elohim et b'nota Adam ki tovoteina. So the woman, the b'nei Elohim, whatever they are, literally sons of God, maybe it's powerful people, they saw the daughters of the human that they were good. Vayikhu lahem nashim mikol asher bacharu. They took whatever they wished. So we have in both situations, we have seeing and taking. In each case, the one who sees that it's tov. In the first instance, it's the explicit contravening of God's command. In the second instance, it's not an explicit command, but they should know better, clearly. You don't need to be commanded. You can figure it out. That taking people by force is not acceptable. And in each of the two instances, what follows is God limiting life. In the first case, the statement that human being is now mortal. In the second instance, two verses later, the years of the human shall be 120. So we have these two instances. The second case, in which the woman doesn't take but is taken, has to do not just with taking of a fruit, but taking a person. The second instance is taking people against their will, taking by force. Those are the first two stories. They're clearly embedded in the creation narrative. The second story immediately precedes the story of Noah. It immediately precedes God being unhappy with creation, and God, Vayinachem, God is sorry God created the world, and God decides to destroy the world except for Noah, Noah Matzachain. So these two stories are clearly embedded in the creation narratives. Now we come to story number three. Story number three, it's actually a very important story. There we are told that Sarai is seen and she is taken. We have the seeing and the taking. The Chumash, interestingly enough, has not abandoned the word Tov. The word Tov also appears in the story. In fact, it appears immediately preceding the seeing and immediately following the taking. Avram said to Sarai, "Say you are my sister, Vumanyi Tavri Bavurech, Pechaiton Nafshi Begorech." And the verse after she's taken is, "Uli Avram Heitiv Bavura." And for Avram, it was good on her account. Which means that a possible interpretation, I think the most plausible, is that what the Chumash is saying, however we understand Avram's motives in all this, what the Chumash is saying is that the crime of seeing and taking was committed by Pharaoh and Pharaoh's officers, but the benefit, the tov that accrues to the one who does the crime, the benefit was accrued not only by Avram and not only by Paro and his officers, perhaps not primarily by them, but by Avram himself. We Avram Hitiv Bavura, which makes Avram an accomplice to the crime. Now actually, in my view, that's a simple reading of the Chumash. Now I'll tell you the one who understood the shot this way. Rashi, of course, would not be happy with this, no doubt. But there's somebody who had a better understanding of the story than Rashi. Much better, actually. You know who that is? Sarah. Sarah understood exactly that way. Chamosi Olecha. Story a few chapters later, when Hagar looks down upon Abraham, upon Sarah, Vatekal Gevirta Bieneha. She looked down, she was light in her eyes, and lo and behold, Sarai's anger is not primarily directed against Hagar at all, but rather Chamosi Olecha. She says to her husband, the Chamas, which is the violent injustice, the wickedness, is Olecha. I gave you this woman, and now I am light in her eyes. May God judge between us. Those are fighting words. And one is reminded that when Abraham went down to Egypt in chapter 12, he went down because the famine was kaved, was heavy. When he left Mitzrayim, he had gold and silver. V'yavram kaved ma'od ba'mekneh ba'kesef u'vazahav. The Chumash is playing off two words that often appear together, which is kaved and kal. And it's not just play on words, it has a deep significance. The money was very important for Abraham. He's trying to build his empire. His wife, who's provided no heirs, is much less important. From Sarai's perspective, the anger in chapter 16 begins, she says, this is not the first time you're doing this. This was the same situation back in Mitzrayim. And in fact, this very Hagar herself, this Egyptian slave woman, we know that Abraham, among the other gifts he was given Avadim and given Shvachot. So presumably, this was one of the payoffs that Avram got, L'man Yitavli Bavurech. So Sarai's anger is directed against Abraham, not just for chapter 16, but also for chapter 12. Now you might ask the question, why is this important? What is the significance of this particular interpretation? And the answer is, it's significant in many ways, but I'll tell you the most important way that it's significant. There are people that are writing, some not bad, by the way. There's one fellow in the Gush who's one of the best guy there. He's writing a whole book about Abraham. He's going to explain the Abraham narrative to us. But there's one small problem, which is, it's the same problem some of us have when we started learning Chumash, you know? We went to the started learning Chumash, and we began from chapter 12. We began with the story of Lech Lecha. They didn't bother teaching Breishis for this, whatever reason, they started with Lech Lecha. The problem is, the Chumash doesn't start with Lech Lecha. The Chumash starts with Bereshit. The Chumash starts with the creation stories. And the point is that if you don't start with the creation stories, you fail to understand something about the Abraham stories, which is that the Abraham story is the beginning, perhaps, of the patriarchal narrative, Jewish history, the family and all that. That's true. But the Abraham story is also the end of the creation story. As we discussed last week, the Akedah is the completion of God's plan in creation, the discovery of a sacred place in this world, the alternative to Gan Eden. That's Har Moriah. That's the Akedah. So when you're reading the story of Abraham, you have to read it from two perspectives. It's to be read as the beginning of something. He is the Av, Ram, the great father, the exalted father, the first. But he's also, in a sense, the last. Because from Adam to Noah, there are 10 generations. And from Noah to Abraham, there are 10 generations. And you have to read the Abraham story, both in terms of a beginning, but you also read it as a continuation and ultimately a completion of the creation stories. And that's the point over here. What Abraham does is not just wrong. The apologist can apologize forever. But the point is, it's not just a mistake. It is the primal sin. That is the primal sin. Seeing and taking is the primal sin. It's the first sin. It's the sin of the powerful ones who take whatever they please, because it's B'nai Elohim. In the case of Avram, he didn't do that, but he was an accomplice. And in order, the entire story of Avram from beginning to end is Avram's way of working through that problem. That is the dominant problem. The dominant problem is not just the mistreatment of Sarah, but more important is his perception. What is her place in Abraham's life? In the beginning of his career, he doesn't see her as having an important place. She's my sister. You can love your sister. But in Genesis, she doesn't share your destiny. And what he has to come to understand is that his destiny is connected to, intertwined with Sarah's destiny. That the covenantal heir is Sarah's child, actually. Not the one that he prayed for. Heinuli lo natata zera, but our child. And that the working through of that problem, with all its ups and downs, is absolutely central to an understanding of the Abraham narrative. Without that, anybody who writes about Abraham without understanding that fails to grasp what is central to the Abraham story. Doesn't matter who wrote it. The Chumash is clear as day. Now, it actually has great relevance to us as well. But now in reviewing, for our purpose, Migdal Bavel, two consecutive stories. The first is the story about the human being who thinks that they, in this case, humanity, will establish this sacred space, and not only that, our sacred space ascends to the heavens. Migdal v'rosho b'shamayim v'naseh lanu shem. We determine our own fate, we can control the earth, we can control the heavens. That's the first story, Migdal Bavel, and the second story that immediately follows it, it's the story of Mitzrayim. It's about the king, it's about the Pharaoh, the king who sees and takes. That's what kings do. Kings see and kings take. And they don't ask any questions. They presume that everything is there for their taking. And in fact, it's interesting, since I've been thinking a lot about the Megillah, which is all about kingship. Megillah is, it's not about kingship, but the setting of the book is kingship. There's one king, Achashverosh. He's the king in the beginning, he's the king at the end. And the Megillah describes a culture of a world, one might say, which Achashverosh is the king. It's interesting to think about. We don't think about Sefer, we think about kingship. We think about Sefer Shmuel, we think about Melachim, maybe the Megillah. But in point of fact, the first book of the Torah has stories of kings from beginning to end. The first king, of course, is Nimrod. The first kingship is Bavel, Reshit Ma'amachto Bavel. Then we have right after the story of Pharaoh, chapter 12. Then we have in chapter 14, four kings and five kings. Then we have in chapter 20, Avimelech, the king of the Philistines, who again makes another appearance in chapter 26. Then we have, of course, whether Shechem and Hamor are kings or not, he's prince, Nasi Aretz, and then Pharaoh at the end of the Chumash with Yosef. Chumash, he's one of the main characters. In fact, I was curious about this. Not that this is a conclusive proof of anything, but I was curious about the number of times that certain people's names appear in the book of Bereshit. So I said to myself, well, the first two places, I mean, first is God. God's name appears the most. God's names appear the most. When you get after second place, Bahavdil, we have two main characters who almost have the same number. Yaakov is one, and Avram is the other. That's not surprising. But who was in third place is very surprising. It's not what you would think. Third place belongs to Paro. Paro's the third. In other words, the book of Bereshit, kings and kingship, are very central to the book. It's very central. So I was thinking about this in connection to the story of Yosef, the story of Migdal Bavel. I was thinking in conjunction with the Megillah. How does the Megillah begin? The first chapter, of course, tells us that in this world of Hodu V'Yakush, and a very good friend of mine, he comes, he teaches the Jewish every summer, his name is Dudi Goshen. So he went for 8 years in the Gush. Then he went off to India. So he sent me Shalach Manas the first year he was in the States. Dudi Goshen, who comes me Hodu V'Yad Gush, he wrote me. Anyway, so in the first chapter you have the world of Achashverosh, the languages, 127 languages. And then you have the second chapter. In the second chapter, it's interesting. What is the second chapter? The second chapter tells us of the Megillah that Achashverosh wakes up to remind himself that his beloved Vashti, or not beloved, but the queen in any event, has been decreed against Vashti that she is no longer the queen, as we all know the story. So his various helpers, Narim, say to him, listen, you want to replace Vashti, let's have this contest. Let's procure the women, young women, from all the various states, bring them to the king, and the one that pleases the king will become the next queen. And the matter, Vayitava davar b'yenei ha-melech v'yaskein. So that's when the Megillah introduces Mordechai and Esther, who has no mother and no father. Mordechai takes care of her. And then we are told that all these young women are being brought to the palace. And they are prepared for each one for a year, 6 months of treatments, one kind of beauty treatment and another beauty treatment, to be brought to the king. 127 states. In each state there are officers particularly for this whole project, and this goes on for several years, I would add. And what's interesting is when you read this description, which from one perspective, and I'll get to this, is sort of comic. I mean, it's, I think intentionally so, it's ludicrous. But what's interesting is the language of this story. The women, we are told, are taken. Vatilakach Esther. Esther is taken. That word appears several times in the second chapter, to take. And what also appears many times in the chapter is that they are good to look at, tovat mar'eh. They're good to look at, so we have the seeing and we have the taking. And the word that appears several times is the word tov. So we have the king seeing and taking what is good. And in this chapter, it's very interesting that, in particular when it comes to Esther. Esther, as we know, has no mother and no father. Mordechai has adopted her. That's what the Megillah says. It says, Vahi omenet et hadasa, hi Esther bat dodo, ki ein la avvaim, later, Esther is taken along with a lot of the young women. She's taken to the king in verse number 16, but even before that, we are told that she was taken. Again, Batigla Kach, and that's in Pasuk number 8, Pasuk Chet. Vahibi Shamad Vahamach Vidato, Uvikavetz Narot Rabot El Shushan Abiral Yad Hegai, Batigla Kach Esther El Beit HaMelech El Yad Hegai Shamer Anashim. So Esther is taken. She didn't volunteer. She's taken. Together with, I imagine, thousands of other women. The Megillah tells us that after Esther is taken, and Esther does not tell anybody she's Jewish, Lo Igida Esther, Ki Mordechai Tziva Shalot, Mordechai commanded her not to reveal her identity. Uvechol Yom Voyom, Mordechai Mitalech Ifnei Chatzar Beit Hanashim. And every day Mordechai would walk in front of the court of the women to know about Esther's welfare and what would become of her. It's interesting that the Medrash, the Gemara, actually the Gemara in more than one place, and Gemara in Megillah and the Rishonim actually in Sanhedrin, Gemara in Megillah makes a statement that Mordechai and Esther are actually married. One, of course, does not, when you read the Megillah, one does not get that sense at all. So one can only wonder, where is that coming from? What is driving? When you have a Medrash, I think it's always a good question to ask, where is it coming from? What are they trying to say? What are they trying to... Often it's not to be taken literally, but they're trying to teach us something. What are they trying to teach us? And here, it strikes me that the Medrash is picking up on something, which I think casts a light upon Achashverosh, or a potential reading of Achashverosh, because the character of Achashverosh, one of the interesting features of the Megillah, and we could talk for hours about this, but not going to, but I want to confine myself this evening just to Migdal Bavel and the stories which surround it, but the character of Achashverosh can be read in two different ways. In fact, the Megillah can be read in two different ways. It can be read as a kind of comedy. Decisions are made not because they're thought through. And in fact, the king himself is one great fool who makes virtually no decisions. Decisions are made for him. He doesn't necessarily even know what's going on. But people all around him are deciding what should be. That is one way to read the book. The other way to read the book is quite the opposite, that he's not a fool at all. He knows very well what's happening. He prefers to have others make decisions for the simple reason that when they make the decisions, they also become responsible for those decisions. But he knows, understands perfectly well what is going on. Now, I think if we had, this would be an interesting study for us, maybe some other time, to go through the Megillah, and in several places, to note that both possibilities are there, and to figure out in each case which is more probable in the text. It's quite an interesting study. The Gemara, the Medrash, the Gemara and the Gemara, Melech Tipesh or Melech Rasha, is he a wicked king? Is he just a fool? But over here, I wanted to call our attention to the following point about Achashverosh. The Megillah goes out of its way to make the following observation. You have being brought to the king thousands of women. This goes to the 127 states, each one with a state office apparently, to procure the women who are prepared. And then we have this picture of Mordechai. Mordechai, we are told, every day, Mordechai has adopted this is his cousin. His cousin is an orphan. She has no mother, she has no father. Mordechai took her as a daughter. And not only did he take her as a daughter, but the Megillah says that every day he would walk in front of the yard to seek out her welfare. How is she doing? To try to he's searching for her. Among the many women that are taken into the harem, he's searching for her. He cares about her. The way that we have precisely that kind of that kind of distinction which is drawn between the one who has everything, the one who has many, many things, perhaps many women, as we see many something else, and the on the other side of it, the person who has only one. So what appears, I believe, in two places which are deeply connected. What's interesting is, you know, I've been reading so much about the Megillah, it strikes me that the second instance, which is very important, was noted by many people that write about the Megillah without actually connecting the two things. They connect them for other reasons, but not for this reason. The story that jumps to mind, of course, is the story of David and Bathsheba. In that case, it's interesting, and that's exactly what the prophet said to King David. You have so many wives. And then the prophet added to David, perhaps sarcastically, V'imi'at v'yosifu l'cha kahena v'chahena. If it's not enough for you, I would have added even more. V'yosifa, I would have added. After Bathsheba's husband is killed, v'yasfa David gathers her into his house. They're gathering in. We often find gathering in produce, gathering in wheat, gathering in many things. In contrast to Uriah, the story of Uriah, of course, he has one wife who waits for him. Perhaps he will come home. Mikadeshet mitumata. The contrast between the one who has so many things and the one who has only one thing, which of course was the parable of Nathan the prophet. When the prophet went to David in chapter 12, he had his following parable. He went to the king. He said, "I have a shiloh," he says. David says, "Well, what is it?" Well, there's a rich man and a poor man. He says, the rich man has many flocks, many, many flocks. The poor man has none, except for one little ewe, one little lamb, which he acquires, and he cares for it. He raises it. She eats with him. She sleeps in his bosom. Vatigo kabat, and she's like a daughter. And then a stranger came to town. The rich man had pity, wanted to spare one of his flocks. So he took the one lamb of the poor man and prepared it for the stranger who came to him. That was the question that Natan HaNavi asked David. At which point David gets angry. Goes completely ballistic. Vayichar David, David's very angry. The person who did this deserves to die, he says. Not only that, he should pay four times. Because he did this and he had no pity. And Nathan said to David, "You are the man." What is the difference between the poor man and the rich man? The rich man has many things. He has many, many objects. He has many flocks. The poor man, in the parable, has none. Not that he has one, actually. He has none. Because what he has, it turns out, is not an object. It's a member of the family. Vatigo kabat. Something that he cares deeply about. He takes a personal interest in vatigo kabat. The contrast, therefore, is not between just quantitative contrast. The indictment of David, actually, who's the rich man of the parable, is very deep. It's you have many objects, but actually, the one who has so many objects has nothing but objects, which I think is an accurate indictment, at least through the reading of Sefer Shmuel and the beginning of Sefer Melachim. David has many, many, many objects, but a relationship with somebody that is real, in the pshat of Sefer Shmuel, he doesn't have. Svatio Kabat, they're picking up on something over here about Mordechai and Achashverosh. Mordechai, there's one person that he actually cares about, to the extent that he actually acquired her, another, he brought her into his house, he cares for her, and she's not just another one of the women. She's like something he cares deeply about. He's every day going, b'chol yom v'yom, he is mitalech. Every day he's going there to walk in front of the courtyard and to inquire about her welfare. It's the same Mordechai who refuses to bow down b'chol yom v'yom. It's interesting, the connection. The one who refuses to accede to Haman b'chol yom v'yom is the same Mordechai who's mitalech b'chol yom v'yom. On the other hand, what about Achashverosh? What does it say about him? So from one perspective, he's committed the great crime of David HaMelech, which is to take the one who takes whatever he wants, disregarding the other people. But there's something else that Achashverosh does in the next chapter, which is chapter 3. After these things, he appoints Haman as his chief executive. He raises Haman up, Haman Agagi. Agag, of course, is the king of Amalek. So not only does he not, I would say he doesn't kill Amalek, he actually appoints Amalek, favoring Amalek, acting kindly towards Amalek. That was the great crime not of David. David never does that. That was the great crime of King Saul. Vayachmo, he has compassion, not on his flocks, but compassion on the wicked king, compassion on Amalek, compassion on God's enemy. So the Megillah, actually in chapter 2 and chapter 3, the seeing and the taking, that's what kings will often do, take whatever they want. There the Megillah recalls for us not just the story of Mitzrayim, the story that follows Migdal Bavel, but it recalls for us kings who see and take. Amongst them, and in fact the only one of the kings who actually does what Abraham feared. Abraham was always afraid, they'll kill me and take my wife. But the Pharaoh and the two Avimelechs, for whatever reason, not that they're not capable of it, but they never did it. The only king who actually does it is David. He kills the husband and he takes the wife. But in truth, there's actually another story. The Megillah actually was preceded by another person who commits the crimes both of David and of Shaul. It's interesting, many have noted this king in connection to the Megillah. Of course, there are other connections, but not noting this particular point. There's another instance, actually, of the story of David. David and Bathsheba plays out in a different way in the Tanakh, in a very famous story. Where is there a story of David and Bathsheba? The replay. The Megillah is a replay, but there's an earlier replay, which no doubt the Megillah itself noted. Which story is it? Amnon? No, I don't see that. Amnon, you have this taking, no doubt. And Amnon is connected to David and Bathsheba, in fact, the next chapter. But I had a difference. It's not there about the man who has everything, as opposed, Amnon wants everything. But the contrast of the man who has everything. Exactly. It's a very important point, by the way. See, once you see that, suddenly it opens up a world for us. I'll repeat it for us. Right. The story is this. There's another story of a king. His name is Achav. King Achav has a palace. He has many palaces. But in one of them, up north, he has a next door neighbor whose name is Navot. And Navot has a beautiful vineyard. So Achav says to Navot, he says, look, he says, it's right next door to me. It's a beautiful vineyard. I'll tell you what, I'll give you a good price for it. Or, if you wish, I'll give you a better vineyard some other place. So Navot says to him, he says, God forbid, he says, Chas v'shalom. Why Chas v'shalom? This is my father's inheritance. In other words, it's not just a piece of property, that's what he's saying. It's not just in the family. But you have to remember that the land which comes down to me from my ancestors, that's my connection to God. Chumash spends a lot of time describing how the land is to be divided. The land is God's gift. He says, Chalila, Chas v'shalom, he says, God forbid. It's a sacred piece of land. There is no other piece of land. So what does Navot do? He goes home and he sulks. Now what's interesting is, in the previous chapter, if you know your Bible, the previous chapter, there's a story about Achav. In that chapter, Achav goes to war against the Arameans. The king of Aram is named Ben-Hadad. In the first battle, he defeats Ben-Hadad. The prophet goes to Achav then, if you remember your Bible, I believe it's chapter 20 of Malachim Aleph, and he says to him, that Ben-Hadad has been told that God is only God of the mountains and not of the valleys. So we'll fight God in a different place and we'll defeat their God. So the prophet says to Achav, because Ben-Hadad has challenged God, God will give you the enemy into your hand. He's God's enemy. So Achav defeats Ben-Hadad the second time. Ben-Hadad runs away. Then Ben-Hadad says, he's counseled, he says, why don't you go to the king of Israel? The Jewish kings are very compassionate people. The Malchei Chesed. Maybe he'll show you Chesed. Oh, he's still alive, says Achav? Bring him to me. So he makes a whole treaty with him. Afterwards, a prophet is standing in the street and he has someone to hit him. So Achav passed by. He says, help me, help me. So Achav says to him, what's the problem? He says, listen, I was told to guard somebody to watch him. I let him go. So I got beaten up. It's not right. You won't even pay me my wages. Achav says, what do you expect? You were told to guard, to watch, not to let him go, and you let him go. You got what you deserved. So the prophet takes off his disguise. Because you let go Ish Chermi, because you let go the one who was destined to be destroyed, your life instead of his. Achav went home sullen and sorrowful. That's the last verses of chapter 20. After these things, there was a vineyard to Navot in Emek Israel. The biblical author puts together the two stories. Now, by the way, once you read that, you go back to the text, you'll find many allusions to David and Bathsheba there. Back to back, there are two stories. In the first story, it's about letting go God's enemy, whom the text calls Ish Chermi Cherem, which of course was Saul's great crime, because it wasn't his role to forgive or to let Agag go. Because Amalek is not Israel's enemy primarily. Amalek is God's enemy. So the crime of Saul was letting God's enemy loose, false compassion for God's enemy. That's the first crime of Achav. The second crime, of course, was David's crime, which is to conspire to take away the one thing that is dear and sacred to the other person, even though you have so many objects. And the way he does it is interesting. This was noted by many. This they saw. How does Achav get Naboth's field, actually? How does he get it? He doesn't do anything. Achav doesn't kill Naboth. He's lying in bed. His wife comes home. Jezebel, what's wrong? Naboth, I offered him good money for his field. You're a king? She says, you leave it to me. So she sends letters. Svarim. She sends letters to the princes and the judges. Bring Naboth up to trial for blaspheming God and king. Get two witnesses. Find him guilty. Take him out to be executed. And then apparently, as the Gemara understood it, the property reverts to the king. That's exactly what happens. So they bring him up on charges and they have two witnesses and they declare him guilty and they bring him out to be executed. And Achav is told, you can go inherit the vineyard of Naboth. Naboth has died and the field is yours. So he sets out to inherit the field. Unfortunately for him, someone's waiting for him there at the entrance to the field. That's someone you want to meet if you're Naboth. It's Eliyahu HaNavi. It's the last guy in the world you want to meet. HaRatzachta V'gam Yerashta. What's interesting, of course, is that somebody else had the same idea, that I will secure my goal not by directly hurting anybody. I have somebody else do the killing for me with the same mechanism, the use of the sefer. And who was that person? Of course, Achashverosh is true, but before you get to him, how about David HaMelech? He writes a sefer, and even worse, he writes a sefer to his general. Bring Uriah to the thick of the battle, retreat from him and he will die. And he has Uriah carry his own letter, for goodness sake. Uriah carries his own letter. What's interesting is, there's something very deep that the Megillah picked up on, actually. There's something very, very deep about it. Because what the Megillah picks up on is that in these two stories of the Sefer, it's not just a matter of words, there's a deep connection between them. Why do we have a king in the first place? The people ask for a king. The Torah actually never tells us what what a king's responsibilities are. The Torah always speaks about excess. The king shouldn't have too much, too many wives, and too much money, and too many horses. Shouldn't bring us back to Egypt. King should write a Sefer Torah and read it, and carry it around with him, not to be haughty, and not to deviate from God's command. But the Torah never tells us what the king should do. But the people, in the 8th chapter of Shmuel, Aleph, they say what a king does. Ushvatanu malkeinu v'yatzalu faneinu v'nuchamet mochamoteinu. The king has two roles. Number one, he's a judge. And number two, he's a warrior. He fights our battles. What's interesting is that the two instances of writing the Sefer, in the first instance, that of David, who writes Svarim, there, of course, what is David doing? What is the crime? It's not just murder. What is David? What is wrong with that picture? What's wrong is that he uses the war to prosecute, to advance his, up to solve his own problem. In other words, he summons Uriah from the battlefield, if you remember the story, presumably to hear how the war is going. But he couldn't care less how the war is going. In fact, if you remember the story of David and Bathsheba, remember that when Uriah reports what's happening, David says nothing. David doesn't respond. Because the point is to bring him from the battlefield to send him home to his wife, he hopes. And nobody will know the paternity of the child, because Bathsheba's already pregnant. But it's early in the pregnancy, and they didn't have DNA tests and all that stuff, so who's going to know who the father is? That way he'll solve his problem. Because it's messy to have the next potential king of Israel have potentially another father, another lineage. So David wants to solve the problem without bloodshed. Send him home, nobody will know. But he found a stubborn person in Uriah. So ultimately, he sends the Sefer. The Sefer is, have him die in war. Let him be killed by my enemy, by Israel's enemy. He's using the war. His job is to kill the enemy, not to have the enemy kill one of his best soldiers. Uriah Achiti is one of listed as one of David's great warriors. In fact, in the book of Shmuel, which lists all the great warriors of David, he's listed last, which is interesting. In the Chronicle now account, he's listed in the middle. There's other implications for us, but not now. But the point is that the Sefer, in the case of David, is using the king as warrior, but he's using that role for himself to solve his own problems. In the case of Izebel, it's the other aspect of being a king. Ushvatanu malkeinu. You should be the judge. So there, Izebel says, it's so malicious, because it's all two Edom, she says. Make sure you get two Edom. Edom's not enough, you know. Get two Edom, get a court. Make sure the Dayanim have been certified by the chief rabbinate, no doubt. Certified by the chief rabbinate, and we have two witnesses, and it's all kosher, and then take him out to be killed, as the Gemara says, not just here. All the modes, all the proper modes of law have to be observed. But of course, it's so deeply wrong. It's the framing of it. And then, by law, you can take his land, because it's all legitimate, it's all legal. And that's what they're picking up on in the Megillah. So Achav is a combination of both. It's funny, because Achav himself is a relatively appealing character. He's not really a bad... When you meet the guy, you like him. He's not... He feels bad. He likes Eliyahu. He's dominated by his wife. On the other hand, the text doesn't let him off the hook. Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. Have you murdered and then possessed? It's not even clear if he knows, but if he doesn't know, we should know. He knows in some way. He could have found out. He suspects. He doesn't ask any questions. Let's put it that way. So the character of Achashverosh is drawn essentially from Achav, the writing of the Sfarim, which he doesn't write. In fact, he never even asked Haman, who are these people? There's a bunch of people out there that don't keep your laws. They have their own. It's not worthwhile to keep them alive. Gives them his ring. Do whatever you want. In the first chapter, when Vashti won't appear at his drunken stag party, he has convened all the cabinets. So, you know, there's emergency cabinet. The Roy Pnei HaMelech, Yodei Dat Vadin. There's a whole cabinet meetings, midnight meetings, no doubt. What should we do with Vashti? So I want to annihilate an entire people. No problem. Yeah, take. So part of it is funny, you know. but it's also scary. And that's the point of the Megillah, actually, the condemnation of kingship, of Malchut. What it's picking up on is, when you look at the Chumash, going back to Migdal Bavel, we have two consecutive stories. We have the first about the people, and Bavel is not just the people. Bavel is the world, but the world has come under the dominion, under the leadership of Shinar. Shinar is Bavel. Bavel is identified in the Chumash a few verses earlier with a man called Nimrod. So Migdal Bavel, and the next story, which is the kings who take whatever they want, who see and take. Those two stories are one after the next, and they speak to what kingship often is in this world. And that's exactly the kind of kingship that the Torah rejects. It rejects Bavel. God scatters them from that place, from that very place. And Mitzrayim is the place you can't be. And in fact, the king is commanded in the Chumash not just not to be excessive, but not to take the people back to Mitzrayim. So that's the first point I wanted to make about Migdal Bavel. It's in context of Mitzrayim and Bavel. Now time is so limited. Let me make a second point about Migdal Bavel, briefly. And there's so much more to say here, but I have to just stop with one more point about Migdal Bavel. Migdal Bavel is, I mentioned last week, that it's very important to, it's important to study everything. But in particular, when you're studying, no matter what you're studying, it's always good to get a strong foundation. In particular because the biblical narratives play off each other. One text connects to another. And I think it's fair to say that there are within the tradition foundational stories. Stories that keep on appearing and reappearing throughout the Tanakh, which are picked up on by our tradition of Torah Shebaal Peh. And they're constantly being reworked and being presented in different lights, in different contexts. And Migdal Bavel is one of those stories. I mentioned last week a couple of the places where Migdal Bavel is present. It's present at the beginning of Sefer Shemot. It's present in Megillat Esther. It's present in Yaakov's story of Yaakov leaving home and discovering Beit Elohim and Shar HaShemayim, which is actually Bavel, the gateway to heaven. But it's also present in another story. And I wanted just to conclude with the following observation about another story in the Chumash. So, briefly, and this could have been the Shiur, but just briefly, till 9:30, 8 minutes, let me say something about another story in the Chumash. A story that, when people read it the first time, they wouldn't put it in great stories of the book of Genesis. They wouldn't consider it to be one of the more important literary literary pieces of Bereishit. And that's the story that appears in chapter 14 of a battle of four kings against five kings. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, the king of Shinar, and other kings, they had a war against five kings, the king of Sodom, the king of Amorah. That's how the chapter 14 begins. And then it says that the Torah then tells us how this battle came to be. It says for 13 years, for 12 years, the five kings served the four. In the 13th year, they rebelled, Maradu. In the 14th year, what happens in the 14th year? The four kings who are in the north come down and they fight battles. Whom do they fight with? They fight battles with the Rephaim, the powerful ones, the Amim, the Zuzim, the Amori. Amalek is found in this chapter. And then, after they defeat all of these powerful nations of Canaan, they're going back home. The five kings come out to attack them. And again, the Torah lists all the names of the five kings and the four. And then it adds, it's five against four. Now, when I teach this chapter, I ask people, before you know what the outcome of the battle, who has the advantage? The five kings or the four kings? Invariably, my class will say, well, the five kings have an advantage. I say, why? Well, it's five against four. Now, of course, that's a ridiculous answer, but it's not so ridiculous because the Chumash wants you to say that. The four kings, Vahibi Mei Amraphel. It's interesting, by the way, when you read these closely, When you read the story of the battle of the five against the four, the king, the main king in the battles, is named Kedar La'omer. Kedar La'omer ha'mulachim asher ito. But when the Chumash lists them off, and it came to pass in the days of, the one that mentions first, who never appears again, is Amraphel, the king of Shinar. In other words, you might say, in the days of Alexander the Great, or in the days of Ahasuerus, right? But you wouldn't say, in the days of, I don't know, Governor Christie or something, I don't know. You wouldn't say that, right? I mean, he might say it, but the point is, you wouldn't say such a thing. Alexander the Great is king of the world. Ahasuerus is king of the world. But he be made Amraphel Melch Shinar. Talking about Babel. Babel is the great city. Babel, Elam. These are the five little nobody kings are five little nobodies. And in fact, when you read the so-called battle, what becomes clear is it's not a battle at all. It never is a battle. The four kings are walking home. The five kings run out the so-called to attack them. They promptly either run to the mountain or fall into slime pits. And the four kings simply walk vayelechu, vayelechu, take the people, take the food, and go home. There is no war. In the eyes of the five, they're very important. But in the eyes of the Chumash, which is laughing at them, there can't be a war between the four great kings of the earth and the five nobodies. The point then becomes that chapter 14 is an example, I would say, not that common, of biblical comedy. There are comic elements to the story. The idea of the kings who come out to war of Vayetze and they fall, not fall in battle, but fall into slime pits. Emek Hasidim, which is a play on Sodom, or Yam HaMelech, which is a play on Melech, king. And there's no war, there's no battle. And at the end of it, you have the king of Sodom coming out, not to thank Avram for returning everything, but Tenuli HaNefesh Varuchush Kachloch, in contrast to Malki Tzedek, who appears at the end of chapter 14, who comes to greet Abraham with bread and with wine and with a blessing. Blessed is Abraham to the Most High God, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed is God who enabled your enemies, who gave your enemies, who enabled you to defeat your enemies. Hashem Yigein Tzarecha B'yadecha. And Abraham gave Malki Tzedek Maaser Mikol, he gave him a tithe. But what is that story about? He gives him a Maaser Mikol. The point of the Chumash is this, I think. The Chumash, which begins with the king of Babel, Amraphel Melech Shinar, is among other things a meditation upon kingship. In the story of chapter 14, there are 10 kings. There are five, there are four, and there's one king at the end of the story, Malki Tzedek. The virtuous king. The five are five powerful kings who were no damn good. And the four are five of five powerless kings who were no good. The four are four powerful kings who are also no good, who think only about themselves. In contrast to chapter 14, to one person who thinks about everybody but himself, which is Abraham of chapter 14. He thinks about his nephew. He thinks about the men that go with him. Chanichav, Yulidei Beito, Na'arim, Honor Eshkol, Mamre, to make sure they take their portion. But Avram himself refuses to take anything. Imichut v'yatzroch now, don't give me anything. But I will give a tithe to Malki Tzedek, who in that chapter, of course, is the tithe. He's the one good king of the ten. There are 10 kings. There's one virtuous king out of 10. So that's probably the right proportion. The nine kings in Nogu, but there is one king who reflects God's kingship and who comes to Abraham with a blessing. And the blessing is, Abraham, you are blessed to the Lord, creator of heaven and earth. And blessed is the Lord who enabled you to defeat your enemies. What's interesting is, and I'll end with this observation about biblical comedy. There are very few instances we have of biblical comedy. The Megillah is one of them. Time did not allow really under the significance of the fact that it's a comedy, which some other time maybe. It's very interesting. But chapter 14 is interesting. From one perspective, the Chumash is laughing at the kings, the five and the four. But that's not to say that it's not a serious chapter. Chapter 14 is an enormously important chapter for us for two reasons. First of all, because the language of Malki Tzedek and Avraham, Baruch Avram Li'el Elyon Konei Shamayim Varetz Uvaruch Elyon Hashem Migen Sarecha Biyadecha, the language of Malki Tzedek is those two verses are the two verses that our tradition has taken and has put and has adopted them as the most important piece of liturgy that we have. Without question, the most important piece of liturgy we have in our tradition is what we call the Amida, and the first blessing of which is of extreme importance. If one doesn't have kavan in the first blessing of the Amida, you have to pray again. El Elyon Kone Shemayim V'aretz is the Yerushalmi's, we have Kone Yakol. Hashem Migen Sarecha Biyadecha. Baruch Ata Hashem, our version is Magen Avraham. Why is that? What did they see in this? They saw the story, and not just that, I would add, all the language of chapter 14 is also found in chapter 15. Chapter 15 is the covenant God makes with Abraham's descendants about the land called the Brit Ben Habatarim. Every piece of Brit Ben Habatarim is coming out of chapter 14. How do I understand it? So I would suggest the following. What happens in chapter 14 is Abraham symbolically has captured the land of Canaan. He defeats the four kings who themselves have defeated all the nations of Canaan. The Zuzim, the Amim, the Chori, the Amorek, Amori. All the list, the same list of Devarim, the beginning of Sefer Devarim. Symbolically, you have captured the land of Canaan. So Malki Tzedek says to Abraham, you are blessed to God. You have fulfilled God's plan in creation. What is God's plan in creation? God's plan is to secure a sacred space. It was initially the Garden of Eden. Now it's the alternative to Eden, the land of Canaan. You, Abraham, have secured that place. You have done God's work in this world. So you are blessed to God. But God enabled you to do it. God gave you the resources, the abilities to do it. Ubaruch Eloyon Hashem Migen Sarecha Biyadecha. So they saw in that blessing to Abraham, who fulfills, this is the true alternative to Eden. The first, which is the land of Canaan. And that's, I think, how our tradition understands what we call prayer. Because our prayer, you stand in prayer. What are you saying in prayer? Through the prism of Malki Tzedek, what do you say in prayer? You say the following. So many have emphasized, Rabbi Soloveitchik emphasized, and others, that prayer is about bakasha. That is the view of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and of many, and the Rambam seems to say this way, but the Baal Shem Tov had a different reading of it. Personally, I'm with the Baal Shem Tov, I must tell you. It's sort of differently. Baal Shem Tov says the following, if I understand it correctly. You stand before God and say, I am here to do your work. I have my particular mission in this world. We have different missions. Nobody can speak for the next person. I want to do your work in this world. And then we say, but in order to do your work in this world, I need the resources. I need the insight. I need the wisdom. I need the material resource. I need the health. Give me the ability to do your work. That's how the Baal Shem Tov understood prayer. That's what Malki Tzedek says to Abraham. Abraham, you have done God's work in this world. Kone Shamayim V'aretz, which is how the Chumash begins. The creator of heaven and earth is the same one who creates a sacred space, which is the fulfillment of God's creation. You have fulfilled or helped fulfill God's plan. And blessed is God who enabled you to do this, who gave you the ability, Hashem Migen Sarecha Biyadecha. So we stand in prayer and we recall. It's not just the citing of words, we are recalling the story of Abraham in chapter 14. And then, we also remember, perhaps, that in chapter 14 leads us to chapter 15, which is the covenant, the eternal covenant about this very place, that those who follow your footsteps, those who go down to Mitzrayim and leave Mitzrayim and capture the land and are able to stay in the land because the land requires a certain mode of behavior, that those that work in your footsteps enter into the covenant. So chapter 14, the comedy of chapter 14, it's funny, the five kings and the four, and the Emek HaSidim and Yam HaMelech, and all that, which begins with Bavel, which begins with Nimrod, which is also a parody. And God goes down to see them. We're going to build the towers to heaven. Vayered Hashem, God went down to see the city and the tower that the humans had made. The Chumash is laughing at us, at the humans, who think we can be God. That's, the comedy doesn't mean it's not a serious story, and I leave all of us with a reflection upon the Megillah, which is a very funny book, actually. But that's not to say it's not a dead serious book, because what the Megillah is actually about is not about Achashverosh, it's not about kingship. Those are the givens of the book. It's not about God's hiddenness, God's absence. Those are the givens of the book. What the book is actually about is, how does one live under those circumstances? How does one live in Bavel? Imagine we're in Bavel. How does one retain a moral compass in Bavel? How does one retain one's values, one's identity in Bavel? And if Achashverosh sent out a sefer, Sefer was sent out with or without his knowledge, either he knew or should have known. But the Megillah also ends with the Sefer, which describes the holiday of Purim, which describes about taking responsibility for the other, which describes Matanot Rev Yonim. Mordechai insists on it, that it be a Jewish holiday. Everybody must be cared for. No one should be forgotten. The idea of memory, which is central to the Megillah. Remembering Amalek. Remembering evil and the fight, eternal fight against evil. That's our Sefer. That's the way we are united with all the Jews all over the 127. We have no state in the Megillah. But we do have an identity through the writing, through our language, through our writing, through our script. That's our Sefer. So the Megillah is a comedy of sorts, but it's, from the other perspective, the most serious of all. It's a prescription for living in exile. So this is just a few words about the Megillah. There's so much more here, but it's the beginning. Anyway, thank you. Anybody has any comments? A couple of minutes, any comments? Oh, yes, please. Speak up. I think what is playing off is the Bat Sheva. My claim was that in the story of Vayetzi Kibat, that Bat Sheva is his wife. In the parable, she's a bat, which means there are different kinds of wives, no doubt, but the idea of the bat in each case, certainly in the parable, and Esther, is somebody that you care deeply for. By the way, it's not impossible that Mordechai, in fact, did marry Esther. It wouldn't be crazy if his younger cousin, who he cares for, they also got married. It's like Abraham said about Sarah in the beginning of his life, she's basically my sister. Why'd you lie to me and say she's your sister? She's my sister. Yeah, you're also married. But she's my sister. It's a relation of brother and sister. But my point about the bat being a wife is that there's one place where bat is certainly a wife. That's the story of David and Bathsheba. In that story, in the parable, Batilo Kabat, the reference is certainly to Bathsheba. It plays on the word bat, but Bathsheba is not his daughter. But the point of recalling the Bathsheba story, I suggested, or the story of Kerem Navot, which are both recalled by the Megillah, is to make a point about what kings are prone to do. Kings are prone simply to take what's good for them without regard to the one on the other side of it. And the fact that they have $20 billion doesn't mean they don't want $21 billion. That's the point. They always want more. In fact, and I'll just end with this thought, the Torah has a little prescription for king. The Torah has one thing it says about a king. Should not have excess. Lo yarbe. Lo yarbe susim, lo yarbe doshim, lo yarbe kesev izahav. Achashverosh violates that in spades. In the first chapter, everything is great. Rav. Yamim rabim. Rav ki yad hamelech. The women being brought into his home. In other words, it's precisely, and by the way, it's interesting that in Parshat HaMelech, on the third year, and when he sits on his throne, that's how the Megillah begins. The only sefer he writes, first sefer he writes is how to procure 10 billion women. The sefer in the Chumash, which says do not have excess, is about curtailing the excess. It's about there's a higher authority. In the Megillah, of course, which is hilarious, with the idea that, it's kind of grotesque, 180-day parties, the 7-day parties, the thousands of women being brought in, everything is bigger than life. But at its core, there's a, it's funny, but there's a deep truth, which is that what, that's what kings are prone to do. And I would add, in reference to what I said earlier, that the laws that the king is making, the so-called dat and din, essentially have to do with himself. It's all because of law. There should be a law that women have brought. But at the end of the day, annihilated an entire people. Why? Because they don't. Because they're not keeping your laws. At the end of the day, the critique of law, which is one to be taken very seriously, when laws are promulgated, who is benefiting by the law? Who is making the law? And that's actually a very important point. The Megillah contains, and not just the Megillah, I would say the folk observances of Purim contain, whether it be known to us or unbeknownst to us, a critique of law in general. That's again another shia, which is enormously interesting. But in any event, my connection to the Bat Sheva had to do with the Bat, had to do with, in that particular story, the Bat has a double, certainly the double meaning of daughter, but certainly means a wife. Okay, anyway, thank you.